This episode contains descriptions of violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm thinking in my head, I'm going down. I gotta brace myself. So I'm like, and I gotta get away from him.
In 2013, Donna Ungshako was living in Colts Neck, New Jersey. She lived in a rented farmhouse with her 20-year-old daughter, Kirsten.
So in 2013, I was 41 years old, single. I was really in a good place mentally. I was happy. My social life was full. I was always out and about doing something, going somewhere after work or on the weekends. I was also big on working out in the gym. I worked out 5-6 days a week. I was in the best shape of my life. I was also heavy into mindfulness and meditation.
The morning of Saturday, July 6th, Donna was woken by a phone call.
I want to say it was about 8 o'clock in the morning. I was sleeping, still in bed. I get a phone call. It's my mother. And she says that she was moving some furniture and she fell and she hurt herself and she was in a lot of pain. Take her to the emergency room. She didn't break anything, but she hurt herself enough or she was in excruciating pain. So they eventually send her home with pain meds and she's got pain patches on her back. We get her in bed and settled. And later on that day, we were supposed to have like a family get together at the house. It was some event within the family. But because of my mom falling, we canceled it. That's how my day started.
It was the Saturday of 4th of July weekend. But after the morning she had, and now that her family's party was canceled, Donna was happy to stay home. Kirsten was going out to a party, so Donna had the house all to herself.
I had a bunch of invitations to go to like friends' places, you know, for barbecues and stuff like that, that I was like, you know, I had to turn down and just take care of my stuff. And it's funny because as I was doing my laundry, I was even on the phone with a friend and he was like, oh, just come out, you know, whatever. And I was just so insistent, like, no, I'm not coming out. I'm home for the day. And this is what I'm doing. My laundry machines were in the cellar of the house. So you can imagine how hot it was. There's a heat wave happening. This house that I lived in did not have central air conditioning. It was an old farmhouse. So I had the two windows open and my front door open. So like I'm trying to get like a breeze going in there.
Donna was going in and out of the house to get her laundry from the cellar. And her cat was also going in and out to do cat things. Once Donna's laundry was done and put away, she started to get ready for bed. She turned her bedroom window AC on and took a shower.
I think it was about 11:30 when I went up to bed. I turned the lights out, start to drift off to sleep, and I hear what I think is the cat scratching at the window screen. So I jump out of bed and I'm like, oh my gosh, the cat, let me go let him in. Right outside my bedroom door was a staircase and I didn't turn any lights on. I just whipped open my door, went down the stairs, and right at the bottom of the stairs was the front door. I figured I'm going to open the door, let the cat in, go back to bed, and then that'll be that. But when I got to the bottom of the stairs in the dark, I opened the door and I see this kid standing at the window, which was directly next to the door. And I see the knife that he's like cutting into the screen with it.
This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. The person cutting the window screen was a skinny teenage boy, and Donna had no idea what he wanted.
When I first saw him, it didn't startle me. Like, I was just like, huh? You know, this kind of like, this is weird. And I wasn't feeling startled, but like, it just took like that millisecond where I saw the knife and I immediately I was like, you know, jarred into like, oh my gosh, what is happening right now? So he sees me, I'm looking at him and he's looking at me. And I, in that second, I go to slam the door shut and he comes at the door. And as my hand was, you know, this is the door, and then here's my fingers are over it.
Her finger had been out just enough for the man to cut it with the knife.
That was like the worst pain that I felt when that knife cut like the very tip of my finger, and I just pulled my hand off the door, and I was just, you know, once again, like here, I'm like, what just happened? So he pushes his way into the house, and here he is coming in. So I'm like backing up and backing into my kitchen, and he's literally standing right in front of me with the knife.
How was he holding the knife? Just like down or up?
Yeah, he was holding it down, kind of like mid-level, like, you know, maybe body in like his abdominal area. But it was down a little. So it wasn't like, you know, he wasn't like in my face waving it like or anything. And so he never said anything. So he's standing in front of me. And before I know it, he whips the knife up and he slashed my face. So I'm like, okay, so he cut my face, and my hand immediately went up to my face. So I'm standing there, I'm holding my face. So now he starts slashing my neck. He slash, slash, slash. And, you know, I'm still like, wait, like you cut my face and like, I'm still on this. And now you're like, there's more happening here. So he slashes my neck three times. And in between those three slashings, he had taken the knife and just plunged it directly into my chest. I'm starting to feel like queasy, like faint, you know, lightheaded, I guess. So I'm like slowly backing away. But as I was turning around, he was turning with me. He was following me. And he was very confident. He wasn't like, I better hurry up and, you know, get out of here. He was just kind of like, I'm here. This is what's happening. He seemed very sure of what he was doing. So as I'm turning around, he's following me. And now he has the knife and it's pointing. It's like pointing at me, not in, you know, at any, like he's going to like attack with it. So it just instinctually, I guess, I grabbed it. I tried to grab it, the knife, the blade. And that just went right into my hand, cut it open. And once again, I'm pulling my hand back. So now I'm bleeding from my face, from my neck, from my hand. I make it to the doorway. The doorway was just like another foot and a half or so. So I'm braced up against the wall and he's still just standing there. And he had no emotions. It was just a matter of fact of this was happening. And I start sliding down the wall, because now my legs are giving out and I'm like, I go down and I'm like this, you know, I know this is not a good thing. Like I'm in trouble now. I kind of fall over to the side and I'm kind of like crouched there in basically in fetal position, just trying to guard myself. He comes over, he was like jabbing at me. He jabs, you know, just jabbing. And it was just weird, kind of like, he was kind of like, oh, like, are you still like able to, you know, move and function? Let me just stab you some more.
Yeah, like he was poking you.
Yeah,
with
like
the knife.
Poking and prodding kind of thing. Exactly. And, you know, so I'm trying to like wriggle around and get away from that. And, you know, so in being in fetal position on the floor, like, where am I going to go? You know, and one of the stabs got me in the back of the neck, and that did a lot of damage and caused a lot of nerve damage to this arm. So to the point where it was really useless to me in that moment.
He then asked Donna for her car keys and a lighter.
The car keys were on the table, and there was a lighter in my purse. But before I even directed him to that, I had said to them, and again, the words just came out of my mouth, that I said, I have a daughter and she still needs me. I can't die like this. You know, so he goes over, he goes to the kitchen table, he gets the car keys and the lighter, whatever. He's rummaging around in all my stuff. Then he came back over to me and I was down on the floor, still fetal position. And like he straddled over me and he just told me I was dead and plunged the knife into my chest, pulled it out, and he walked out the door. So I was like, he's gone, trying to like sense like his movement, trying to feel like vibrations. I was waiting to hear like, you know, I'm going to hear the gravel in the driveway any minute, you know? But it was just like dead silence. And something just happened inside me. And I got up. I don't know how I did it, but I did. I remember going up the stairs. I don't remember actually my hands or my feet touching the stairs going up, but I made it and I got to my cell phone, and my cell phone was on the charger and it was on the dresser that was right next to the window that overlooked my driveway.
Donna was terrified that if she lifted her phone up or disconnected it from the charger, it would light up and her attacker would see it through the window and come back for her.
I was so scared. And so I was like, I kind of like, you know, brought it down low to the ground and tried to get it off the charger that way. And when I started to dial, my hands were just covered in blood and I couldn't. And it was frustrating because I was so desperate. So I started to wipe it off on my blankets, my bed that was right there. And I was able to dial 911 and get through to the operator. When the 911 operator answered, I was just so desperate. I was just like, please, just somebody has to, I'm like, I'm dying. Like, I'm going to be dead. Just come and find my body. Just come and find me. The 911 operator, like I could sense like her, like the kindness and her wanting to help. And she asked what happened. What did he look like? For me, I was like, I was determined to get all of the information out. You know, I stood face to face with this kid. I know exactly what he looks like. And here it is, you know, here's a full description of everything. And that was my goal, to get all that information out, because I really thought I was going to die. The 911 operator stayed on the phone with me. I was in and out of consciousness. She had directed me. I told her that I had been stabbed in the neck and I think in the chest. And she had said, do you have something, a blanket or something like that? And I remember telling her, like, I'm near my bed and I have my pillows. I'll grab my pillows. But I never actually made it to the pillows to, you know, to get them, to put the pressure on. So I was, you know, I was going in and out. So the pressure I was putting on wasn't very effective and I was just soaked. And I'm telling her, please, you know, please tell them to hurry up. And she's telling me they're coming. And the next thing you know, I see a flashlight. I see the light from a flashlight. And I'm like, please, please be the police. Cause I'm thinking it could be him. Cause he was just outside and that could be him coming in. Maybe he heard me get on the phone or saw the light or whatever. And I remember just talking to myself saying, please, please be the police. And it was the paramedics and the first two police officers to show up. I believe there was one, it was the first paramedic and two police officers that came in.
Donna was wearing a black tank top and black shorts. Her hair was also black.
So when the paramedics had gotten there, they didn't know that I had other injuries, like injuries to my chest, because I'm like, you know, they could definitely see my face and my neck and everything like that. But I had two holes in my chest that they didn't know about. And it was all like disguised in the tank top I was wearing and the blood that was soaking into it, for them to fully assess and see what, you know, where all the holes from the knife were, was tough.
One of the officers got behind her and held her.
He kind of got behind me and he was kind of cradling me and I lost consciousness. And when I woke up, he's cradling my head and his hands and he's like, you know, help is on the way. And he was just talking to me. And I remember feeling like like looking up and seeing this police officer there. And like, I felt like I could just relax in this moment. Like I'm safe in the moment, that feeling in that moment, you know, I feel just this forever connectedness to that police officer.
Donna was in her bedroom, which was upstairs. The paramedics needed to figure out how to get her downstairs and into an ambulance.
So this is an old farmhouse and the staircase was very narrow and they couldn't fit the stretcher. So they took a sheet and they wrapped me like a mummy, kind of. They just like wrapped me in the sheet.
Yeah, like a little burrito.
Yes, like a burrito, exactly. And I remember them saying, like, we're going to carry you down like this. You got to trust us. And I'm going with it. You know, I had full faith and trust in that they weren't going to drop me. But imagine that. Imagine they show up and you can't get the stretcher. It's crazy to think.
Once they got her down the stairs, she was loaded into the ambulance and rushed to the hospital. She went into surgery as soon as she got there.
I was told that surgery lasted 7 hours, a little over 7 hours. So imagine the damage that he did for them to be doing all of that work for 7 hours. And so to get to all that, you know, they had to basically do like you would in an open heart, and they cracked my sternum open to get inside, and the knife nicked one of my lungs, so one lung collapsed. The knife missed my heart by, well, I forget the millimeters, but they said it's basically the edge of a dime. The knife missed your heart by the edge of a dime. I was in a medically induced coma, so that's not good.
For how long?
I think it was basically just after surgery to keep me calm, I guess.
Meanwhile, Donna's daughter, Kirsten, came home from her party to find their house surrounded by police.
I wasn't expecting Kirsten to come home that night. She was at a party and she was planning on staying at the house where the party was. For some whatever reason, she had decided she was going to come home that night and she wanted to sleep in her own bed. And so when she was coming home, it was, I don't know what time it was, like probably like 2 o'clock in the morning. She could see all the commotion of the lights and everything, the police lights. And she, you know, as she got closer, she realized this was happening at her house. And so when she gets out and says, like, where's my mom? And they tell her, your mom was attacked and she was taken to a hospital. They wouldn't even tell her which hospital. They wouldn't tell her exactly what condition I was in. She had no idea, like, if I was alive or dead or, you know, what have you. And they just kind of basically said, you have somewhere where you can go, where we can take you. One of my brothers lived up the street, literally like 2 minutes up the street. So they took her to his house and basically told my brother the same things, like I was taken to a hospital and what was happening and did he know anybody that would want to hurt me or anything like that and those kinds of things.
Kirsten stayed at her uncle's house that night until they were able to go see Donna in the hospital.
I got out of the surgery and survived, and they wanted to be the first ones to talk to me, the police. So it was, you know, way into the next day that they even knew where I was or what was happening, you know. And then at that point, it was up to my brother then to go to my parents' house and tell them what had happened. My brother said when he walked in the door, my sister was there and she was like, you know, what's going on? She could see something wasn't right. And he told them, my sister at that point, I think she said she just screamed and fell to her knees. And you know, you just can't make sense of it, you know.
Before she was allowed to see her mom, or even before she knew if Donna was alive or dead, Kirsten was allowed back in the house.
Kirsten actually went into the house where the blood was, and the, you know, my blood was pooled and my blood was trailed, and they saw it and they had to step over it. She had to go up the stairs to her bedroom to get, you know, get her stuff, and to get the cat.
Meanwhile, Donna was still in a medically induced coma at the hospital. But they soon brought her out of it and back to consciousness.
I was on a ventilator. And I remember I don't have any recollection of what the ICU room looked like, but I remember being in the room when they were taking me off of the ventilator and I'm waking up out of this heavy sedation. And I couldn't see anybody, but I was told that all of my family was in there and they were around my bed and everybody was talking to me and trying to encourage me. Now they're putting an oxygen mask on me and everything, and I'm like coming to. I still couldn't see anybody, which was so weird because everybody was like, yeah, you were, when they took the ventilator, took you off the ventilator, you were, you woke right up and we were all there and we were so happy and, you seem so relieved and what have you. But I still have no recollection of that visual memory of everybody being around me.
Having her family there was very important to Donna, but having her daughter by her side was imperative.
When I saw her in the hospital, I just wanted, like, I could see she was horrified. I could see the horrified looks on everybody's faces. And it was so heavy for me. And I just wanted her near me. And she was there, I think, every day with my sister, the two of them. And I was so like happy just to have her near me. My mom was there in ICU and, my mom's Finnish, and in Finnish, there's a word and it's called sisu, S-I-S-U. And I grew up with this word and knowing about this word and its meaning and stuff. Sisu, when you try to translate it to English from Finnish, I'm just going to read this. There is no direct translation, but it's basically extraordinary strength of will, determination, courage, and resolve. Resolve to continue and overcome in the face of adversity, backbone, spunk, stamina, guts, drive. It's not momentary courage, but the ability to sustain that courage and strength. And so she was saying to me, you're going to make it. You're going to, you're strong. You have sisu in you. You're going to be okay. You're strong. That story of her doing that, because you can imagine your mom. My mom was 75 at the time, and if you remember, she was in the emergency room, only hours earlier in excruciating pain. But she, it took every bit of her own strength to get out of bed with her own injuries, and get to the emergency room, and to stand by my bedside. So that was like this, like, strong strength, this is my mother, I have this in me, it's kind of thing. So it was just very very encouraging.
As her condition improved, Donna was released from the ICU and put into a regular recovery room.
Now I'm fully aware of where I am, the hospital room, and I'm freaking out. I'm like, this kid is coming here, he's gonna kill me. Like, I'm expecting, like you see in the movies, like there should be a guard outside my door. There should be a guard here in this room. And they're telling me, no, it's okay. This is a secure floor. Nobody's getting on this floor. And I was admitted under an alias. So anybody that knew my name, they told me that was a red flag. If anybody in here comes in and says, hey, Donna, that's a red flag and you need to let us know because nobody knows your real name here. My little nieces and nephew, my younger nieces and nephews and stuff, they drew little pictures for me, dear Aunt Donna, and they put it on the wall in the room. And then, like, the police would come in and they'd be like, no, take that down. And here we are scribbling out my name. And so that was scary. It was very scary. And especially through the night, nobody was there. So I'm here, like, I don't want to sleep. They're giving me stuff to sleep, but I don't want to sleep. I'm fighting it. And I'm just waiting for this kid to come in, dressed in a white doctor's coat. And that's gonna be the end of it. So I'm like, I gotta get out of here. Thursday, I'm like, okay, like I'm ready to go. So whatever you need me to do to get out of here, like we need to do it. They had to have the occupational therapist or physical therapist come in, make sure I could walk by myself up a set of stairs and I could lift things, and they had to make sure I had no blood clots and things. So like all these tests and things were happening and stuff. You know, I was like, I'm doing everything. Just get me. I need out of here. And finally, on Thursday, they discharged me.
Donna was only in the hospital for 4 days. And there was no way Donna was going back to her farmhouse, the scene of the crime. So she needed to figure out another place to go.
So I went to my parents' house. My parents have a pretty decent sized house, but I have siblings that live there with their kids. So there was really no room for me. They weren't expecting me. I got put into my niece's room, who was she was a teenager, you know, so you can imagine a teenager's room, like the walls are like plastered in just cutouts from magazines, clothes all over the place. And I just want to lay down in comfort and safety and peace. And I just want to heal and sleep. And there's all this commotion happening in this room. And I'm just like, oh, I need my own space and I need my bed. And, you know, so it was tough.
Though her living situation was cramped, everything was supposed to get better from here. But that's not what happened.
I kind of felt okay in the idea that I could have scar revision surgery and everything will work out. Everything's going to be fine. I made it through the worst part. It's going to be fine. But that was pretty much the beginning of, I feel like I was in shock for like years, but you know, coming out of the hospital, then the next couple of days and weeks as they went on, you know, I started to have symptoms of post-traumatic stress, and I was like freaking out at everything. I was crying all the time. Like, I wasn't crying like, you know, like you cry when you're sad or something. It was just tears would just pour out of me. Like, I could just be standing there and all of a sudden it would be like, whoosh, this is happening. And, you know, I'd be walking around like, I'm like, I don't know what's happening. It's just happening. I'm okay. Just go about your business. Or, you know, 1 minute I'm like happy and smiling, the next minute I'm like, I have to lay down before I fall down. Or, you know, I'm freaking out because somebody turned a light out or a door was left unlocked. You know, I was very like, lock the doors, lock the doors, lock the doors. What was that noise? Turn the lights on. And if anybody came around and messed with that, I was like, why do you want me to like get murdered? Because that kid's coming in here. Like, in the split second that I looked from over here to over here in my head, this kid got in somehow and now is hiding in a closet or under the bed.
While the police did have some leads on who did this to Donna, her attacker hadn't been arrested.
They kept me informed about everything that they possibly could, because I told them, I want to know everything. If they would say like, we're working on a couple of leads, or we're waiting on these, you know, DNA tests or this evidence, or they're running this or they're doing that. So they knew who he was like right away. I think it was 8 days. The detective had said 8 days, but I didn't know that. I knew they were working on leads.
The night of Donna's attack, police received a 911 call from a Taco Bell 5 miles from Donna's house. There was a young man walking around their drive-thru holding a knife that appeared to have blood on it. Police were dispatched to the Taco Bell, and while they didn't find the man, they did find Donna's car abandoned behind a movie theater nearby. A witness from the Taco Bell worked with a police sketch artist, and that sketch was then shown to Donna in the hospital. It was incredibly close to her attacker. The sketch was circulated, and police received a phone call from a woman who said it looked a lot like her 16-year-old cousin, Brennan Doyle. The woman was able to provide a photo of Brennan at her wedding just days before the attack. He had the same shaggy hair as the sketch. The Doyles lived within walking distance of Donna, and while police were following other leads, they got Brennan's fingerprints and DNA. They matched what was found in Donna's abandoned car. Then, in early October, 3 months after the attack, servicemen were working on the roof of the same shopping center as the Taco Bell and where the car was discovered. They found the knife used to stab Donna multiple times on the roof. It was one in a set of knives found in the Doyle home. Brennan Doyle was arrested in October of 2013.
I believe, according to the mother, one of the interviews, I don't know when exactly the interview was, but the mother had described what he was like when he came home the next day. And he had no shirt on. He was soaking wet. He wasn't like himself. He was in a different state of mind, emotional state. And he had told her that he had buried his phone. So she had taken him to go get his phone. But that was it. She claimed that she didn't know that he had anything to do with the stabbing right down the road. And the father in one of the interviews had said that night there was an argument between the father and the kid, and the kid had, I don't know, presented the knife, you know, to the father, and the father was like, not going to have it. So he locked him out of the house that night. And the mother had gone out to drive his friend home or something. And when she came back, she learned that this happened. The husband locked him out of the house and the kid was gone. And when she was asked, like, well, why didn't you call the police? He was like in an irate state. He had a knife and he was locked out of the house. I didn't want them to shoot him.
Donna attended every single court hearing, first in juvenile court, then in regular criminal court, after it was determined Doyle would be charged as an adult.
At all of these court appearances, where I was, even though he was on video, he could see in the courtroom. So he never like looked at me. I always looked at him, but he never looked at me. So he was instructed probably to not make eye contact, not look at me, not make eye contact. So even though in my head, like at points I hoped for like, maybe he'll just catch my eye and I'll see some glimmer, something to give me like hope that this kid has regrets and is sorry. And, you know, just like, I'm just looking for that little tiny glimmer, but it never happened.
Initially, Doyle pleaded not guilty, but then went on to take a plea deal for attempted murder and carjacking. This should have made the rest of the court proceedings go smoothly.
But at the sentencing, they originally had a date set and like everybody was there. Like all of my colleagues were there. My family was there. All my friends were there. Like it was a lot. And like I worked myself up for it. I'm prepared for this. It's going to happen. I'm going to be so happy. He's going to go behind bars. And this is it. This is happening. And the judge says, where is the father of this kid? And he was not present. He just didn't come. The judge then said like, okay, well, we're gonna come back next Tuesday, whatever, because this kid is going away and it's important that his father be present. So we're gonna give him an opportunity to show up. So then they pushed it. Like, it was like such a slap in the face, kind of.
At the actual sentencing in October 2015, Doyle read a statement where he claimed to be high on mushrooms at the time of the attack. He asked for forgiveness and then was sentenced to 15 years in prison.
So his statement, I thought, was, I didn't find it very sincere. I feel like he was sorry that he got caught and he felt sorry that he was going to be pulled out of his life as he knew it. He came from a wealthy family and lived in a, you know, million-dollar home and had probably everything he could have ever wanted. And he was sorry that he was not going to have those luxuries, I think. So I didn't find it very sincere. With a plea deal on the table, and it was, he had to admit guilt to the court. He had to say it. That was what was important to me, because I was like, even if he gets 4 years and goes to jail, that doesn't mean anything. If he's like, I'm innocent, I didn't do it. Not that I was happy with the amount of time that he got, but I was glad that he had to admit his guilt. I don't think I didn't think it was enough time then. I don't think it's enough time now. Like, I feel like he could do a lot more time. And being, you know, now all this time that has gone by, there's the no contact order. So I will never know if he ever is really truly sorry, or if he ever really understands the magnitude of his actions. That information will never be passed along to me. You know what I mean? Like, because there's no contact. No contact means no contact.
Would you ever be interested in, like, having a conversation with him?
I've always thought about that. And I think I would, but just not right now.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, but I think that, yeah, that I think that would be something I would be interested down the line.
Donna also filed a civil suit against Brennan and his father. A judge awarded her $5 million, but Donna hasn't seen any of that money.
That's something that I need a lot of help with, because so I have an attorney who took my case on contingency. So it goes in front of the judge. There's a hearing. So we walk out of that meeting and my attorney says, you'll never see a dime of it. Nobody's paying and nobody's enforcing it. You know, I have no explanation as to why it's not happening. I really don't.
Did you have to pay that lawyer?
No, he took the case on contingency. And every time I tried to press him about it, he would not take my calls. He would not return my emails. You know, he's just wasn't interested in entertaining any sort of conversation with me, and was insistent that he told me from the beginning that I would never see a dime.
Well, if you don't see a dime, he doesn't see a dime. So I don't understand, like,
exactly,
why he went through all that work anyway.
Right. Exactly. So I'm currently looking for an attorney who will take that. I mean, the case is won. It's already, the award is there. It just needs to be collected.
And Donna could really use that money. In addition to being stabbed multiple times and losing almost 3/4 of her blood, the aftermath of the attack left Donna in a terrible place financially.
I was checked out. Like, all I could do was basically I was just existing. You know, it was like hard to get out of bed in the morning. It was hard to take a shower. It was hard to make it from upstairs to downstairs, just mentally, physically, emotionally, everything. It was rough for a long time. And on top of that, my car that the kids stole, it was taken into evidence. So I still had a note on the car. So I had to pay for that car while I couldn't drive it, while it was still in evidence, and the rental house as well. This happened in July. I believe my lease was up for that year in September. So I still had to pay the rent on the farmhouse that I wasn't living in. So I'm paying rent on a house I can't be in. I'm paying for a car I can't drive. All of my stuff was packed up and put into storage. So now I'm paying for storage. Next thing I know, I'm getting calls like, you know, this is such and such creditor. You haven't paid us in 3 months. Next call is going to be, we're suing you or whatever. So now I'm getting notices like, we're suing you. And you owe us this money times like 3,000, because now we're hitting you with fees and stuff like that. And I'm like, you know, I don't know what I'm supposed to do because I can't function. And that's great. You know, the creditors didn't realize. So it's like, call the creditors and just tell them what happened and they'll stop, you know? So I remember, like, it took all of my energy and effort. And I remember calling them and saying, like, I'm getting all these notices and you're suing me and I'm not paying you. I know I'm not paying you and I'm not paying you on purpose, but I'm having a tough time right now and I can't, you know, I'm not functioning properly and I just need to get myself together. And they were like, we're really sorry to hear that. How would you like to pay for your, you know, debt? How would you like to pay that? You know? And I remember just like hanging up the phone and just crying and just, I can't. So even with all that, all this time goes by and all the notices, and it was so far beyond that I ended up having to file bankruptcy.
Donna knew she needed help handling all of these things, just piling and piling on her.
And I started seeing a therapist. I was going to therapy twice a week. Eventually, I started with a psychiatrist who I was on medication. So I was on medication for anxiety. I was on medication to sleep, medication to wake up, and medication that was supposed to stop like the movie playing in my head over and over again. And talk therapy was what really worked for me. And that was with that's with my therapist, and it's over 10 years. I'm still in therapy. So within that therapy, because of the PTSD diagnosis and how I was responding, there's different treatment modalities, like different things you can do. And my therapist actually does what's called EMDR, and that's eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And that for me was a game changer. At one point, I was like, I couldn't be alone. I was always like, I had to have somebody with me at all the time, you know, all the time. And like, if I was coming home from work at night, I couldn't just come home, get out of the car and go into the apartment. I had to have somebody come to my car, come and get me, come walk with me, come, you know, watch me from the door. And that type of fear, like that just stops you in your tracks. EMDR helped me through that. And I don't know exactly how it all worked out. But one day, you know, I was just free and I was able to walk in the dark by myself. I was able to get from one door to the next and not need somebody to come walk me. I'm completely blown away by that and totally grateful. And I want to tell everybody about EMDR, everybody with a trauma history.
3 months after the attack, Donna felt ready to go back to work. Luckily, her company was very understanding of her situation.
I was very fortunate with my employer, how they kept me on. They covered a lot of my expenses. While my car was in evidence, I think it was about 9 or 10 months, I had a rental car. You know, my company covered the cost of that. It's just not the norm that an employer would do that, but they encouraged me to be back at work. And fortunately, I had a place to go, you know, when I was ready to get back there. But when I say get back to work, I didn't get back to work like I showed up at 8 o'clock and stayed till 5:30. I showed up at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, stayed for like 45 minutes and was like, yeah, I'm just about done, and went home, you know, and I did that for so long. And yeah, and they kept me on and encouraged me to just continue. You're doing great and do what you need to do and take care of yourself. And we got you on this.
Today, Donna is still dealing with the aftermath of being attacked. Like so many others who have been through violence, she knows there's no going back to how things were before.
I think I have a new life now. I am still at the job that I was at, so that's going great. I am not as, I don't know if outgoing is the word. I'm more keep to myself. I'm not so out and about doing things. So yeah, my life has changed like drastically. I'm still trying to get back to that feeling of loving working out. So, you know, my whole physically, I've changed out of that. I'm 10 years older too. So yeah, so it's I live a very quiet, purposefully quiet life. I have a dog now, and he is like my everything, and he keeps me safe, and he allows me to sleep peacefully through the night. Nobody's getting in without him letting me know. So yeah.
What kind of dog is he?
He's a pit bull, and he is he's amazing. He's just the love of my life. You know, outside of my daughter, he is my first son for sure.
Donna has also had to take a step back from her once very tight-knit family.
Unfortunately, I don't have the family connection that I had pre-attack, like my whole family connection just crumbled. I just feel like there were some insensitive and unkind behaviors after the attack, you know, when I needed help and I got the opposite. So I chose to pull away from that for my own peace, I guess.
Oh, sorry. That's the time you needed the most.
And yeah. Yeah. That's the most devastating.
Sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, just due to everything. There's too much trauma and too much. It's just too heavy. And my relationship with my family as a whole, I should say. Like, I haven't celebrated Christmas with my family in 10 years. I haven't sat at a Thanksgiving table with them. I spend those days pretty much by myself. So it's a huge loss in that regard. I have relationships with my family members, like individually, but not as a group, if that makes sense.
Unfortunately, this strained relationship with her family also includes her daughter, Kirsten.
You know, very early on, I think I wanted to talk so much about it. I needed to talk, and I was always talking, and I was like, you know, vomiting my stuff all over and with no filter. And it was too much for her, so she pulled away, you know. And as we started to get closer together, we kind of realized, like, she doesn't want to talk about it. I want to talk about it. This is really awkward and uncomfortable. And, you know, I wasn't going to family occasions. She wanted to be amongst the family, you know, so she was kind of like in the middle. Definitely has put a strain on our relationship. I love her, you know, just the same. I completely understand it, and I'm sure she understands, you know, my need to constantly be in this, but it's not that same carefree, you know, off the cuff kind of, we don't have to think about this kind of relationship. We do think very much about what we're saying, how we're making each other feel, and what's happening, you know. So it's definitely I don't want to say damaged, but it's put a wedge. So if anything that that I would want this kid to know, you know, after the attack, like, that is the worst, you know, the breakdown in my family relationships, and the breakdown with my relationship with my, and the damage to the relationship with my daughter.
Brennan Doyle was sentenced to 15 years in 2015. He will be eligible for parole in 4 years.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm concerned about that. Yeah, I'm definitely concerned about that. I'm not in a position right now where I feel like I'm totally safe and protected, and I just don't. Yeah, I don't feel safe now. And when he gets out, I'm not sure how I'm going to react, but I kind of feel like I'm not going to be okay with it. I can only just hope and pray that he doesn't feel like vengeful, you know, in any way. Yeah, I'm not okay with it. I would have to say I'm scared of the thought of him being out.
Having been through the whole experience of a violent attack and all the aftermath, Donna saw a gap in her area's care.
Things never got back to normal, but things were starting to, I guess, calm down and be more like normal. I couldn't shake that I need to connect with other people. I'm not the first person to be stabbed. I'm not the first person to survive a home invasion. I'm not, you know, this violent crime was happening and people were hurt and what happened to them and all this, you know, I just felt like I needed to connect with people. I tried to find like a violent crime survivor support group and I couldn't find anything. The only thing I could find was a PTSD support group in the city. The whole idea of it was what I wanted and what I needed, but I needed it here in New Jersey, you know, and I needed it specifically for victims of crime.
In 2015, Donna started Survivors of Violent Crimes, a peer support group that also provides resources and knowledge to anyone navigating life after an attack.
You know, hearing everything, it wasn't just the attack. You're not collecting it. You're out of work for 3 months. What do you do if you're not collecting a paycheck for 3 months? Like, there's the victims of crime compensation, but there's a cap on how much they'll cover and all the expenses that come along with being a victim of crimes. You know, it's the need to connect and the need to help people with the things that I struggled with, like knowing where exactly to start with therapy. So I had to find this all out by doing my own research. But so for me, like, if somebody is like, here I am, I don't know what to do, how can we help you in this way? Let's talk about yoga and meditation and mindfulness and healing from the inside. And let's make sure you're eating properly and you're healing your body. And you know what I mean? Like, you know, it's just those little things that you just don't think of. And especially when you're like, what do I do? You know, your world's turned upside down.
Donna is continuing to practice mindfulness and meditation. And this has helped her keep going, one day at a time.
For weeks, I had been meditating on one passage every night before I went to bed. I sat with that meditation, and that meditation is the first meditation in the book, Three Magic Words. The first line and the last line, I'm just going to read it to you because it's so fitting. So it goes like this. I know that I am pure spirit, but I always have been and I always will be. There is inside of me a place of confidence and quietness and security where all things are known and understood. This is the universal mind, God, of which I am a part of and which responds to me as I ask of it. And at the end, no matter what obstacle or undesirable circumstance that crosses my path, I refuse to accept it, for it is nothing but an illusion. There can be no obstacle or undesirable circumstance to the mind of God, which is in me and around me and serves me now. So I think I had that with me the night of the attack, and I think it just was so helpful mentally to get through it.
You can find Donna's peer support organization at facebook.com/survivorsofviolentcrimesNJ. This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul, and you can follow the show on Instagram at Lived to Tell Podcast. If you enjoy today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show.